Just a quick little announcement before we get going. Wanted to let everyone know that this Thursday night at 7 p.m. on November 10th, we will host another episode of Chatting with Larry, which is open for all $5 patrons and above, where you can come on and for an hour or two, depending on how things go, you can talk to Larry about whatever you want. So if that interests you, then check out for the details on the Registry Matters site, where I will post links to the things that you need at registrymatters.co. Enjoy the show.
Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 244. Thank you for the correcting on the script part of Registry Matters. How are you, Larry? How are you this evening?
Doing awesome. Glad to be with you again.
Fantastic. Hey, for those who aren't patrons, we just recorded a Patreon extra. And if you're a patron for as little as a buck a month, which is about 25 cents an episode or less, then you could get in on that action as well. So, but before we get rolling, make sure that you go over on YouTube and press like and subscribe and write a podcast review, share it with a friend, all those other things so that we can grow the FYP Registry Matters family. And there's that. What are we going to talk about tonight?
We're going to talk about a case from the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, originating from the state of Florida. I can't pronounce it, so I'm just going to let you worry about that, but it's an important case. And we're going to talk about some articles. We've got the Mississippi Public Defender System being underfunded, and we've got why is a person being required to register in Texas that didn't commit a sexual offense per se. And there's some other articles if we have time, but yeah, we've got some good stuff.
Excellent. Well, then let's just dive straight into this. And you people put in a case here from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit named John Doe versus Richard L. Swearingen. If I'm butchering that, well, I'm sorry. The plaintiffs here, whose offenses predate the registry, have been subject to this reporting structure since the registry law was enacted in 1997. This is an ex post facto challenge, is it not, Larry?
Yes, it is.
All right, let me set this thing up. The plaintiffs allege the following facts in their complaint, which the court must accept as true. The plaintiffs committed qualifying offenses prior to 1997, meaning they were registered for over 20 years prior to the 2018 amendments. John Doe's 1 and 7 each report in person about 8 times per year to re-register and report information changes, such as those caused by travel. Neither has been arrested for violating the registry law, but they fear that the law has become too onerous that an inadvertent failure to register is unavoidable. I have a story about that I can share with you here later. Similar. John Doe 6 suffers from a mental disability that requires him to depend on his sister to comply with his registration requirements, including his obligation to report in person 4 times a year. Before his sister began helping him, John Doe 6 was arrested twice for failing to comply with requirements that he did not understand. Like the other plaintiffs, he fears the registry law now virtually ensures his future incarceration. It does sound like it's an I gotcha, isn't it though, Larry?
Oh, it is indeed. And it's interesting. In a state that claims to value every penny of taxpayers' funds, and they claim that they seek to eliminate wasteful spending every chance they get, but they create all these I gotchas when it comes to the registry so they incarcerate people. You have to admit that that's ironic.
I will definitely concede that that is ironic. So the story, I'll just slip it in here. So Super Patron Mike tells me that a good friend of his has many cars, and one of them had like screwed up registration and then like some ammunition in the house, something like that. Don't know all the details, but gets arrested for that somewhere right around Halloween when they're doing their compliance checks. Like, these are very, very, very benign, innocuous things, and they just seem that they want to go after some people to lock them up. It does seem like it, Larry.
Yeah, it does indeed.
So after the lawsuit was served on the state, what was the state's response? I can only guess.
Well, the state moved to dismiss the complaint, contending in part that the underlying basis for the claims accrued long ago. For each claim, the state traced the alleged injury to an amendment to the registry law and measured the limitations period from the amendment's effective date. Now, the plaintiffs responded that they were not challenging their designation as PFRs, but the constitutionality of second-generation registration burdens and the continuing threat of imprisonment for failing to meet them.
So what did the district court do?
The district court agreed with the state that the claims were time-barred. The judge said because the plaintiffs were subject to the registry law for longer than the four-year limitations period, and because they had not pleaded that their challenges and alleged injuries were tailored specifically to amendments enacted within the limitations period, and that they were denied, and of course they appealed.
Then the appeals court noted, over the past 25 years, the Florida legislature amended the registry law more than a dozen times. The information collected by the commissioner now ranges from basic identifying information like a registrant's permanent address to details like the license tag number of his roommate's car. Really? Any changes to this information triggers a registrant's duty to report, and failure to comply is a third-degree felony. I'm assuming third degree is minor-ish?
Well, it's down the chart, but still it's a significant crime in Florida.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not first-degree murder, I'm assuming, is a first-degree crime versus third-degree. I'm just saying it's lower tier anyway. And you people have always said that the mere act of registration is not unconstitutional, but it can be depending on what is required. Can you admit that Florida's registration requirements are unconstitutional?
Sure, I can admit that, but what I say really doesn't matter. But yeah, I can admit that.
How are you required to report what your roommate's car? I mean, like, why would that even freaking matter? Like, why would it matter? I'm sure, like, well, why would you be required to do that? How would that pass muster?
Well, there would be a clause in there that would say something to the effect, and I don't know exactly what Florida law says, but it would say something to the effect of a car that you own or regularly operate. For example, you live with a roommate and you share the vehicle. It's not your vehicle, but you regularly operate it, so you would end up having to report that vehicle. So your roommate's car would be subject to disclosure, which could jeopardize the safety of the roommate.
And this has been hailed as a great victory over the past week. What do you say about it?
It is a victory. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say a great one, but it's definitely a victory.
Are you confusing me? So it sounds like you are confusing me. This is not about the constitutionality of Florida's registry.
You jumped ahead. The plaintiffs alleged that the reporting requirements became intolerable in 2018. Is where we are.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the plaintiffs alleged that the reporting requirements became intolerable in 2018. So when Florida again began amending the registry law, registrants are now required to report any absence from their permanent residence for any reason that lasts more than 3 days. That sounds like a prior restraint on one's liberty. Can you admit that?
Yes. If you have to report travel in advance before you're allowed to travel, I can definitely admit that that's a prior restraint. But again, it doesn't matter what I say, does it? So now you're to the part about it being held as a great victory.
Yeah. So this, people have been saying that this is a great victory. What do you have to say about it?
It is a victory to be able to have your day in court. It absolutely is. The district judge just summarily dismissed it, agreeing with the state. So yes, to be able to resurrect this with a 11th Circuit, it is a victory. But we'll get into how great the victory is further down. But I would not hail it as a great victory, but it is a victory. But I prefer to let the court speak. The court said the constitutionality of the registry law is not before us. We must determine where the plaintiff's claims are timely. So that is a victory. Absolutely.
But you are confusing me to a degree. This isn't about the constitutionality of the Florida registry?
It is about that. But the state of Florida argued that the claims were not timely and thus barred. And therefore, they were able to flush the case. So in order to get to those issues that are being argued in the complaint, you had to resurrect the case. So the Court of Appeals only did one thing. They resurrected the case from dead and said, trial judge, you shouldn't have dismissed the case agreeing with the state. And so the case is now being remanded.
So I see. Okay, so the court said stated that the plaintiff sued to remedy various injuries, some caused by the 2018 amendments and some arising from other provisions that have been on the books for several years. How did the trial court respond to that defense?
So, well, how did they respond? Well, the trial court responded by the district court dismissed the claims agreeing with Florida that the plaintiff's injuries stem from one-time acts, the enactment of each provision that allegedly injures them. Therefore, under the applicable statute of limitations, they were required to sue within 4 years of the date of each provision that imposed the challenge burdens. And so it was kind of we don't want to have, the state said, we don't really want to have to defend these issues. So therefore, we're going to throw up a bunch of smoke and mirrors saying that they're time barred. And if we can get the court to buy into it, then we don't have to defend on the merits. It worked. And you have to admit that's funny.
No, I'm not admitting it's funny. And it wasn't to the court either. They said, although the plaintiff's injuries undoubtedly originated when the challenged provisions permitted the commissioner to first injure them, the district court failed to consider whether the plaintiffs, who are subject to the registration requirements day after day, were continually injured by the requirements within the statutory period. I remember when you people were litigating in New Mexico regarding non-New Mexico convictions, you asserted a continuing violation doctrine. Isn't that relevant here? What is that doctrine that we were talking about then?
Well, it's great because that's exactly what salvaged the case. According to the court, the continuing violation doctrine permits a plaintiff to sue on an otherwise time-barred claim when additional violations of the law occur within the statutory period. If a defendant's actions violate plaintiff's rights on a repeated and ongoing basis, then a cause of action may be timely even if the first violation took place outside the statute of limitations. And they cited Callaway versus Partners National Health Plans, and that was a case from the 11th Circuit in 1993. So that's resurrected this case for now.
Was that relevant to the court's decision?
Yes, it is. The court stated that, quote, examining each of the plaintiff's alleged injuries and claims individually, we conclude that the following claims are timely or satisfy the continuing violation doctrine. Count 1, count 3, count 3A, count 3B, and count 4A, and count 4B, and count 4C, and count 5. Conversely, we conclude that count 2 and count 4D are barred by the statute of limitations. So it wasn't a clean sweep, but they get to go back to the trial judge to dismiss them, and they have to litigate on these issues.
The court also stated, we believe the plaintiffs have alleged a continuing violation. The registry law requires the plaintiffs to make multiple in-person reports each year, even if nothing about the registration information changes. In addition to that requirement, each day the plaintiffs must try to determine whether an action they take, whether, for example, they wish to purchase a new car, book a weekend trip, or create a new and online account requires making an in-person report. The complaint contends that these reports are time-consuming and burdensome, and the plaintiffs allege that they have foregone certain opportunities because of the likelihood that they would have to report information to the commissioner. Is this not a disability and restraint? Totally sounds like a disability and restraint to me, Larry.
It is indeed. And in terms of, I don't know if I was clear enough on the continued violation doctrine before I get the rest of this answer, but the continued violation doctrine is really not that complicated. You can have a continued violation, and the way that Florida wanted it to be interpreted would yield an absurd result, which the law is not intended to yield an absurd result. So let's say, for example, the statute of limitations is 3 years, like what we had in New Mexico in the case that you mentioned. All of our plaintiffs had been on the registry for more than 3 years. And they asserted that doctrine here. And I said, no, it doesn't apply because the injury is still happening. So although the initial injury happened before the 3 years, it's continued to happen. So the violation is still occurring. And there's a continuing violation doctrine. The lawyers weren't keen on the argument. Certainly the judge wasn't, which was more important. But we made a weak argument about continuing violation doctrine, and then we shifted to another argument, which I can't readily recite, but we abandoned the continuing violation doctrine. But just think about this. So the sheriff in Bibb County comes out and arrests you. And make it a sheriff in Bernalillo County, since it's a 3-year statute here. and they manage to keep you in custody for 3 years without you contacting a soul. They forbid you to have access to anything. You're never successful in smuggling a phone in. You're never successful in contacting the outside world. 3 years and one day later, they decide to let you go. So they've had an unlawful detention for 3 years. You were never charged with a crime. There was never even an affidavit of probable cause. The sheriff just went out and arrested you and held you for 3 years. That would yield an absurd result to say that you should have filed a complaint within the 3 years because you couldn't.
Well, the
PFRs are in a similar situation. They fear filing complaints and, quote, rocking the boat. Because they know that the registry people are, in most cases, going to double down. Now, this does not apply in Maryland, which is purest of German snow. They would never do that there. But in most jurisdictions, they're afraid that they're going to be double down. Their families are going to be targeted. Their employers are going to be told bad things. Their apartment owners are going to be told bad things. So therefore, out of fear, which is the same as what happens, they don't file a complaint. Well, the person in jail couldn't file the complaint.
Sure.
And so, therefore, it's absurd. But anyway, the court recognized that contrary to commissioner's suggestion, this injury is not caused by the plaintiff's initial designation of PFRs, but by the state's continuing threat of enforcement of the registration and re-registration requirements. The court recognized that.
Fourth and finally, the plaintiffs argue that they have been injured by their very classification as PFRs. The plaintiffs contend that they are being unconstitutionally punished under the Eighth Amendment. That's under count two, because the law imposes obligations on them until they die without any individualized assessment of the risk of reoffense. And what did the court say about that one?
Well, the court didn't buy that one. The court said, we believe the counts about this alleged injury are based on nothing more than the lingering effects of the plaintiff's initial designation as PFRs, which occurred more than 20 years prior to this lawsuit. The plaintiffs were either provided with an appropriate process before they were, quote, punished by being placed on the list, or they were not. Either way, their claim was complete at the time they were categorized as PFRs and made subject to the law's requirements. The continuing violation doctrine does not save this type of claim.
I still don't quite understand, Larry, how somebody commits their crime and all that stuff prior to the registry, and I get that this is a civil regulatory scheme, but how does this type of obligation to report information, how does this not cross that Kennedy Mendoza doodad of particularly the disabilities and restraints when you have to do all of this reporting stuff? And it doesn't seem like there's no evidence that it supports anything. So then how do they get away with pulling this one off, especially in Florida, where it's really, really over the top crappy, without somebody filing challenges and getting them rolled back when other states have done it successfully with lesser restrictions?
Well, because they have not successfully proved that those disabilities are punitive. There's been too many summary judgments, motions filed. There's been too thin evidentiary records going up, and the cases have not been done as well as they should have been. And remember, the burden is on the challenging party to prove that this is, in fact, a punishment scheme despite its so-called civil regulatory name.
Where, in your opinion, like seriously, as you as like the legal strategist person, you've talked about there being something similar to something like a constitutional registry where maybe you just mail in a postcard or something along those lines. Can you articulate where the line gets crossed from where Florida, like if they rolled it back far enough to be X, would it be simply like there is a way to get off the registry after X amount of time or something? Would that do it? Is there anything in your brain that would look like rolling it back far enough where these challenges would go away?
Well, certainly a way off of the registry would be a start, but also the disabilities of what people are not allowed to do, where they're not allowed to work, those are going to have to be peeled off, particularly for the people whose offenses predate those obligations. You can't impose restraint on people through a regulatory scheme and it be constitutional. Certainly after the fact. Now, you might be able to do it going forward if that's an expectation and something that's going to happen to you as a result of the collateral consequence of a conviction going forward. But the people who've had their obligations either imposed upon them after the fact or increased dramatically after the fact, that's really problematic. So you'd have to take out all the things, like kind of like what Michigan did. You remember in Doe versus Snyder?
Sure.
The court really hammered them on the disabilities or restraints. And most of those were peeled out for the old people. You know, they can live where they want. They can work, I think, where they want. And there's a path off. That's a part of it. I don't remember how Michigan provided a path off, but I think there's a path off in Michigan. But you're going to have to peel off significant layers, taking the registry back to where it was probably in the very beginning, if you want it to be constitutional.
And, but that's only for people that were convicted before X date. If those convicted yesterday, they're going to have all of this crap piled on them for them to report. Is that, I believe that's what is going on here as well?
Well, these particular plaintiffs are all pre-existence of registration. But yes, there are people who will have continuing complaints because if your sentence has ended, my contention is there can be no disabilities or restraints imposed upon you through a regulatory scheme. Only reporting is all that can be imposed on you, and reporting of things that were in essence in existence at the time of the offense. But
so
what
chance?
Kind of car you drive, all those things that weren't a part of the original offense, the name of your offense, the age of your victim, the date of your offense, the jurisdiction of your offense, those type of things, that's public record. That's longstanding public record. What you did, what you pled to, or what you were convicted of, your mugshot at the time, but where you're going to school, where you're working, who you're living with, all those things were not a part of the original conviction. Those are forward-looking requirements. And those are huge disabilities when we tell you you can't live somewhere.
Right. I got to think. I don't know. Do you think, like, I think 75% maybe of people's issues would go away if they didn't have residency restrictions, work restrictions. I'll put those two together. And then secondly, if your information weren't just immediately available on a public website.
And even if the website were public, if it didn't put your pinpoint, your address, if it just put a city or maybe the name of the street.
If you put a city, Larry, some people live in cities with like 300 people. They're going to be able to figure out who you are if you put a city.
Well, then you should
maybe a county or something like that.
You should get the heck out of that small city.
Truth. With all that meandering, what happens next on this case?
Well, it goes back to the district court for determination on the merits of the surviving counts. So the district judge, despite his wishes, is going to have to conduct a trial, or they'll do their famous motions for summary judgment and ask the judge to decide it without a trial. I would not ever encourage a motion for summary judgment. If you really are serious about this, then you need to raise some money down in Florida, maybe even approach NARSOL about assisting and make sure that there's a solid evidentiary record. Let's don't end up like the case in Colorado with Judge Mache, where there was no evidence to support his findings. You've got to have evidence when you're going to strike the will of the people and say the will of the people is null and void. We can't just do that because we feel emotions. It's got to be proof.
Larry, I got to say that you almost sound optimistic on this one. You sound optimistic that they'll get their day in court?
Well, they will get their day in court, but I'm not that optimistic about this because the 11th Circuit just handed down that horrible decision we discussed in McGuire versus Strange. Remember that one?
Vaguely.
Well, the one where the brother moved from Colorado to Florida.
I remember that for sure. I just don't know the cat's name. But yes, I remember that.
Yes. Okay. Well, that is binding precedent. Remember, the 11th Circuit is Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. So we've got a binding precedent of a registry that's equally as bad as Florida's, where the court has already said it doesn't cross the constitutional line. So it's hard for me to be optimistic when I've got binding precedent in the circuit. So what they're going to have to do to have a chance of winning is they're going to have to distinguish the disabilities and restraints that exist in Florida to make them more excessive than what exists in Alabama. And remember, Alabama did peel off some of the requirements that of the dual reporting. Not much, but they took the driver's license notification, you know, the lettering of driver's license. Alabama did a little bit to clean up the registry, but most of the disabilities are still there. And you can't be optimistic when you realize that the 11th Circuit is bound by existing precedent. They could only come up with a different decision if this has been so distinguished in a way that they can say, that panel decision is not valid here because this is a totally different case. But if the issues are very similar, they're going to come with the same decision because that's just the way the circuit courts work.
Gotcha. I mean, you're saying, if I'm going to make this kind of comparison, the 11th Circuit being where Georgia is also, that they said you can't do the Halloween signs, then they do something sort of similar in Florida with signs, and then they can try and figure out how to pin it to make it seem like it's similar to the Halloween signs? Because it's the 11th Circuit, it would be binding there too.
It would be binding, and the argument you would make would be that you can't do it because a previous panel has said you can't do it, and that wasn't appealed. Therefore, that's binding in the 11th Circuit. So you would, what Florida would do if somebody made, if some jurisdiction made a law about signs, they would have to distinguish themselves. So, well, this is not really what they were doing up in Georgia. We're distinguishing ourselves. We didn't do that. We're actually only applying it to people who've gone through this process, and they are more appropriate candidates. We're not using the blanket imposition on everybody. You could possibly get away with it by distinguishing yourself, but that's what these people are going to have to do. They're going to have to say, our registry is so much more onerous than Alabama's if they expect to win. Otherwise, I cannot be optimistic.
So I think we're going to change your name to Mr. Doom and Gloom for the duration of our time here doing FYP Education and Registry Matters. I think that's what we should do.
Mr. Doom and Gloom, really?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to give you like a superhero outfit. You'll be like a supervillain. And so you are Mr. Doom and Gloom.
So, well, I'm just telling you what I'm looking at in the way of the... I can't make this stuff up.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well, there's that. So we have some time to kill. We started this at 7:26, so we're 30-ish minutes in, not quite. So we will cover some articles. One of them was passed along from an individual that resides in Florida, and it is a post from the Florida Action Committee website. 40 PFRs arrested in Hillsborough County in Halloween operation. And in this little clip, I could go to the article, but it's enough that 40 of them that were arrested, I think it was 37, had violated their probation, meaning they had missed curfew. They, all that benign stuff that's just a technical violation. So I guess you could say that they did find the three people that did significant violations, right? Right?
Well, without disclosure of what those violations were, I don't know for sure, but it doesn't seem like the best utilization of funds in the state that claims they're so conscientious about public funds, but go ahead.
We've covered this over the years. I remember forever ago, we covered something coming out of Pennsylvania where they were just looking for some sort of anything that they could find to put you back in with their thumb on you for violating some terms. And I mean, I guess if you didn't register an email address, that would be considered a violation that you would get nailed for.
Absolutely. But what did these special operations cost? When you put together these teams to go out, they're on overtime, I would imagine. Okay. They're multiple agencies, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we could speculate at them making $20 an hour base pay, $30 an hour base pay, 50, 40, 50, 60 grand a year as just a beat cop. And then you're saying throw in overtime. So 60, let's call it $70 an hour. Fair?
Yep. So.
And then 5 hours, because they got to be there early to like suit up and get all their tac squad gear on and look all threatening. And they go out, 20 people cover a county. I don't know what number that is, even number of people covering in a county.
Well, they're huge undertakings and lots of money being expended. And they did find some conditions of supervision violation. But remember, if they went out and knocked on everybody's door and they didn't find anything, that's difficult to justify conducting the operation. So you have to find things. Even you have to look really hard. You have to find things, right?
Yeah. So now it's almost like you're the traffic cop, and if you don't come back with at least some number of speeding tickets, you didn't do your job. So you had to find somebody that was speeding, whether they were or not.
That is kind of the way the system works. I don't make the rules, but if you're going to have these operations, they're going to find things to arrest people for. They're not going to come back in and say, oh, things are pretty good out there today. Doesn't work that way, folks.
So this is them. This is almost like the wagging the dog, the tail wags the dog, that if they go out and they don't find anything and they do this multiple years in advance, in a year in a row, then the public would be like, why do you keep doing this? So they have to find things to report.
Absolutely. And that's the reality of life. I had a person call the legal hotline here just a couple of days ago from some small, I don't even think I need to name the city up in Minnesota, but his son has had a relationship with an underage girl, and they put him on probation. And he's finding probation to be very challenging because of the things you're describing, you know, how closely they're supervising his son. And he said, I don't understand this. He said, they're treating him like he's some kind of hardened criminal with all this, all the requirements and all the checking they're doing. And it's just such a waste of money. And I said, it's ironic you should mention that. I said, we're about to have an election in a few days. And I said, remember, when you vote, whichever way you vote, you've got candidates telling you that law enforcement needs more resources. And you've got candidates telling you that law enforcement, some of the resources they receive are not best used and they should be redirected to other purposes, including maybe some treatment, counseling, and other things, and just having so many officers looking. And I said, is it possible in that jurisdiction that you've overfunded your law enforcement apparatus because they were so happy? He said, they made this case and there's so many other crimes out there they should have been focusing on. I said, really? I said, I don't know that we can say that if it's a small jurisdiction. There might not be a lot of criminal activity. You may have given your police more resources than they need. And they had to make the case because your son, for all practical purposes, is a sexual offender. He broke the law of the state of Minnesota, and they had to prosecute him. Point being, there's an election coming up in 3 days. And if you truly believe what you say about all these frivolous charges that are being made, then you might want to be a little more receptive to the argument that we've got too much funding going to law enforcement. If you believe
the police crap.
I'm not using that term, but if you believe that we have frivolous cases being made, and I think a lot of our audience believes that, the only way you will stop frivolous cases being made will be you'll have to diminish the ability to make frivolous cases, which is a resource question. If you believe that there are not enough cases being made, then you need to vote the other way. You need to vote to give the cops more resources, more funding, so they can make more cases. The decision is on you. So,
I know that you put in the Operation Blackout for the Memphis one, but it's the same thing. There's no more detail in that article.
Nope.
All right, so we'll move along. Do you want to do the underfunded public defender system in Mississippi?
Yes, this is going to be informative in terms of the public defender system.
So this is from Mississippi Today. I didn't realize that Mississippi had a publication called Mississippi Today. The system is not designed for you to win. Underfunded public defender system penalizes Mississippians. How about that for a word, Larry? Mississippians.
All right.
And I'm sure there's some reason why you wanted to put this in here. This doesn't have anything to do with the PFR stuff.
Well, maybe it does. So, like most public defenders in Mississippi, of this article, Malate, how do you pronounce her name, who is the public defender of those counties I can't pronounce, was appointed by a judge. She represented an unlimited number of defendants for a fixed payment that often did not cover the cost of investigators or expert witnesses for the cases. Many times when Malate filed a motion for her client, she said that she thought twice to make sure she could prove to the judge she was not wasting time and money. And she said, my first priority, quote, my first priority is to my clients. But that was always balanced and tempered against how bad this was going to, quote, piss off the judge.
I'm going to call it Mallette's, but it could be Mallette. So the article says that Mallette, so that's the public defender person, Mallette's experience is not unique. In Mississippi, attorneys who represent the indigent in criminal cases have to deal with an underfunded public defender system that lacks statewide funding and oversight. In an ideal criminal justice system, the three components, law enforcement, prosecution, and defense, would be balanced in order to work fairly. But Mississippi spends significantly less money on the public defender system than its counterparts, the district attorney's office. And what do you say to that?
Well, I'll just quote from the article. The funding discrepancy results in an indigent defense system that fails to provide state oversight and ensure independence from the judiciary. Since the system allows judges in counties without funded public defender office to have control over how attorneys are chosen and compensated, indigent defense attorneys might fear if they push too hard, they will lose their job. Now, that's what the article said.
And public defenders are appointed by the courts for defendants who cannot afford their legal representation. Of the 82 counties in Mississippi, only 8 have full-time public defender's office. That's because there's only 8 counties that have enough people living in them. The vast majority of counties hire part-time contractors to provide legal representation. Meanwhile, a few counties appoint lawyers on a case-by-case basis and pay an hourly rate. What's wrong with that idea?
Well, it's wrong because of disparity in treatment, depending on the county. Some counties are not very generous. Even if they have that compensation system, they may have a very, very low hourly rate. But according to the article, attorneys working in the counties with no public defender offices often have little control over their defense process because they can't begin their work, meaning they're not going to get paid for their work until the person is charged. In Mississippi, the constitutional right to even have an attorney doesn't kick in until the defendants are indicted. While some counties appoint lawyers only after indictment, most counties and cities appoint 2 sets of attorneys to specialize cases in different court levels. And they cited the case of Duane Lake, who was in jail without a lawyer for almost 3 years before he got indicted. He eventually spent 6 years in the Coahoma County jail for a murder he didn't commit, which I assume means he was found not guilty or the charge was dismissed. So that's what's wrong with it. We've got a system in Mississippi. I think they rank up in the top 3 in the rate of incarceration per 100,000 population. Sure. And they don't provide any consistency in defense for their citizens. And again, if the people of Mississippi wanted to provide criminal defense, pursuant to a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1963 called Gideon versus Wainwright, they would demand that of their elected officials. They don't. It's not important. And therefore, this is what we have.
Do you, in your opinion, should dollar for dollar go to the DA and PD?
I don't know that you can make that simple comparison, because there are people who have the resources to be represented by private counsel. The state has to prosecute everybody. They don't farm those out to private counsel. So if you have 1,000 cases in a jurisdiction, the state is going to have to resource up for all of those. Of that 1,000 cases, you might have 300 that are privately represented. So I don't know that a dollar for comparison is necessarily the way to go, but I don't know that it isn't either, because even though the private defense bar is covering some of the representation, the state system has a lot of resources that are not really visible to the person. For example, all the investigative resources of law enforcement, those are paid for by government. So the local police, they were government funded. The investigators that work for the DA's prosecution office of the state attorney, those are all publicly funded. So they have, and they can send stuff to the state law enforcement, like in the case of Georgia, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the case of the FBI, they can sometimes rely on the FBI, depending on what they need. They send stuff to the lab in Quantico. They have all these resources that are publicly funded. So maybe it should be equal, even though there are fewer people. There are some people who are not represented by the public defender because of the investigative resources and the expertise that the state has, that the defense bar has to hire and pay for.
I understand. I was just wondering, I'm sure there's no public support for it, because it's like crime is bad. Crime is going through the roof, whatever. And they're guilty, obviously, or else the DA wouldn't even bring charges. So screw them, don't give them any constitutional protections or anything like that, and lock them all up, because that's what we do.
That is what we do, and it's unfortunate, because in this country of ours, where we're supposed to presume everyone innocent, the Supreme Court said decades ago, almost 60 years ago, be 60 years next year, that they said that you're entitled to representation. If you can't afford one, the state will provide you representation. So the state is attempting to put you in a cage, and the state bears the burden of proof of putting you in that cage, but yet the state gets by, despite 60 years of precedent, of not providing you with representation if you can't afford it. You end up in a cage in a country where we claim liberty and justice for all.
Alrighty then. Then let's go over to this Reason article. Why is Texas requiring a guy who stole a car to register as a PFR? When states misuse PFR registries and apply them to any crime that involves a child, individual rights are abused. There are some crimes that are very bizarre that you would end up on the registry. So why? Let's see. Why did you put this in?
Because it's interesting, and the title of the article is a bit misleading. Yes.
Roan Michael Weatherly has never been convicted of anything sexual related. Yet once he is released from prison, Mr. Weatherly will be required to publicly brand himself as a PFR. Mr. Weatherly will live with the obligations and consequences of being registered in the state of Texas, including the state's monitoring of his movement, incursions into his privacy, reputation harm, restrictions of his housing options and educational goals, and limitations on his recreational activities, despite the fact that he has never committed a sexual offense. And how do they do that, Larry?
Because he was convicted of a registrable crime under Texas law.
And how can they do that?
Because three offenses listed on the sex offender registration list trigger PFR requirements without requiring any finding of sexual conduct, intent, or action. These three offenses are kidnapping, aggravated kidnapping, and unlawful restraint. They carry mandatory registration requirements under Texas law, despite being crimes that are not necessarily sexual in nature, and that's under Texas Criminal Code 62.001, subsection 5E.
Can they win this case if the law requires registration? I'll take that as a no.
There's no additional finding of sexual intent or conduct required by the courts or the Department of Public Safety for a conviction of unlawful restraint to trigger the PFR registration requirement. In addition, a first-time conviction for unlawful restraint of a minor child under 17, which was the case with this, was like a four-year-old, that automatically requires registration on Texas PFR list. This is a choice for the people of the state of Texas to make.
And I have read all 299 paragraphs, Larry, if you can believe that. You're sitting there telling me that this case is already on life support. No wonder you people, we refer to you, we've changed your name to Mr. Doom and Gloom.
Well, I'm telling you that at first glance, and I didn't read all 299 paragraphs, so you're ahead of me. But just having read the complaint for the first time, this is a weak case. It is for the people of Texas to determine how broadly they wish to apply their PFR requirements. It's not for lifetime unelected judges wearing black robes to overturn the will of Texas unless they have violated the Constitution. They have to prove that the Texas registration scheme is unconstitutional, and they have an uphill battle. That's a steep climb, but that's what they have to do.
So I also noted that Georgetown University Law School is listed as the attorney for Weatherly. How does a whole university become the attorney for an individual? Does that impress you at least?
Well, it's not the entire school, but yes, you did notice that correctly. there is an attorney from that law program, but it doesn't change the reality. Now, listen to what you're saying. You're all of a sudden saying of people that our audience, I've heard states' rights and keeping the big old bad federal government out and no legislating from the bench. All of a sudden, I think I'm hearing you say that despite the fact that Texas chooses to have a broad list of registrable crimes that includes this kidnapping, that they can't be listed on the PFR registry. And that is for Texas to determine. Now, I think it's despicable. I think it undermines and neutralizes. If you're going to call it a sex offender registry, you would almost think that someone who's on that sex offender registry would have committed a sex offense. I mean, right? Doesn't that seem somewhat logical?
That seems entirely logical to me.
So it would be nutty to have, but we have states across the country that have sex offense and violent offense registries. And we defer to the state's rights. And all of a sudden I'm hearing, it sounds like a little bit of pointy-headism coming out of you, that you want to thumb your nose at the states and have the black robes decide what the people of those states can do. And I'm not sure that that's going to fly well in the federal courts, particularly as they're comprised today. I just don't think this case is going to have, certainly I wish them well, and I'd be happy if I were asked for input, but they've got to prove that the Texas registry is punitive before they can limit the application of the registry. Merely naming someone to be on a list, I don't think it's going to get you there. And I haven't read the entire complaint. Maybe we'll come back to this case later. But
because I mean, we the people get to decide what we prosecute as crimes.
And we get to decide what our civil regulatory schemes regulate. You got to prove it. You got to prove that the registry is not just a civil regulatory scheme. You got to go after the whole thing. And somewhere in those 299 paragraphs, did it look like they were attacking the registry itself?
I didn't see anything of that sort. So
yeah. Well, maybe like I say, I'll do it. Give it. I just actually got it yesterday, so I didn't have a chance to read it with a thoroughness. But the answer as to why is he being required to register is because the law requires him to. You know, why is he being labeled a PFR? Because he's on the list. That crime is on the list in Texas. And they're asking a court to limit the list, and I'm not sure a court can do that.
And then I think this will be enough to close out the program. It says, this is from Forbes. Military veterans in federal prison have a program meant to assist in their successful return to society. I'm assuming there's a but in there. So why did you put this in here?
Well, there was a but. It doesn't look like that the prison system is doing a great job of utilizing this option. So the money's there.
So the opening paragraph says, our military veterans are the pride of our country, but many have challenges after returning from service where they face hostile environments under stressful circumstances. While most transitions back into civilian life, mental illness, trauma, and drug addiction are too often part of life post-war veterans. I was getting my hair cut the other day, and the lady cutting my hair said that her nephew, did the second Gulf War and did a bunch of tours over there and is not right in the head after coming back and just really struggles with functioning day to day. And I feel for him. And it's almost like in my brain, Larry, it seems that if going and doing horrible things to people, shooting them, all that stuff that goes on in war, if that doesn't affect you, you have problems. If it does affect you, you also have problems.
Well, it says there are 10,000 veterans in BOP custody. That's a huge number. I mean, I think the BOP has something around 180,000 inmates last time I looked.
Yeah, I was thinking it was 200. So that's like, is that 5%?
So, yeah, that's a huge number. Now, they're not all PFR related. It says the two-thirds of the offenders are...
Sure.
But I think there's a huge number of veterans that are also homeless or near homeless, but apparently
is also pretty common.
There's programming available to help these people, but apparently it's not being utilized. So we got to do
anything like
that.
The state system, then you have to go through some kind of counselor and they don't want to work and they don't want to do much to help you. And you don't have any outside resources generally to help you. Someone in chat can speak to finding people that help them do anything on the outside. So you're a person with an unlimited amount of time, but no resources to do anything, where the people on the outside have resources, but no time to do anything. So you're just stuck.
So, well, it says the BLP reports incarcerated veterans through its collaboration with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The BLP acknowledged that veterans, as a result of their service, suffer from higher instances of trauma, anxiety, depression, and physical disabilities, which can be pathways to the criminal into the criminal justice system. But what
well,
are you
doing?
Well, what are you
good.
Doing? What are you doing about it? So it's kind of like it piggybacks on our last episode. You know, we have such great admiration for these people, but all of a sudden when they get into trouble, we forget them. You know, this is being published in Forbes, which is not exactly a liberal publication.
Truth. Well, very good, sir. I would like to point out that we did get a new patron that came in. The name is Chris, so I'm a little, I would say he, but I don't know that it's he. It could be a she. So, Chris, thank you so much, and did an annual subscription, so that's really freaking awesome. And then another Chris, spelled with the traditional CH, who's already a patron, did a very generous donation to FYP Education, and I can't thank that person enough as well. Anything else before we head on out of here, Larry?
Well, I did get a couple of letters that I haven't responded to yet, so I'd just acknowledge to Timothy in Ohio that I did get your FYP, did receive your packet. But we haven't been able to focus on it yet. And also, I received another one. How much time do we have left? I might can do this one.
Give it 5. If we started at 26 and we're at, if we started at 7:26 and whatever it is, it's 7:15. So we have like 7-8 minutes, really.
So, well, let me take a look at Frank's submission. I think I can answer it, because the answer is going to be I don't have an answer, but I want to acknowledge Frank sent us something.
Well, that doesn't help. So,
well, but I'm going to try
Frank,
to find
there's
out.
There's no answer.
He says, Dear Andy and Larry, greetings once again. Forgive me for getting straight to the business. Well, we don't need to forgive you. That's what we want. My question is regarding the, pronounce the Pennsylvania case, T-R-R-S-I-L-L-I-E-R-I, that case that we had on a couple of weeks ago.
Sure.
So I'm twice convicted, PFR, from the Middle District of PA, halfway through my sentence, with a prosecution, with a projected release in 2030, as I am one of the rarity of people who have reoffended nearly 7 years ago. How will that case apply to me? Will I still have the right to reputations? How will this ruling benefit me? And I don't know the full answer. The right to reputation does not have an exception that I could see for anyone who has had a second transgression. So I don't see that alone, but in terms of what Pennsylvania did and how being a repeat PFR, how that's going to affect you with the modifications they've made to the law, I do not know. But I will endeavor to try to find out. Maybe we'll have our expert from PA come back on soon.
Very good. Sounds like a plan. So anything else? Did you want to try to do the other letter ad hoc?
No, there's too much there. That one's a thick one.
Very good. Well, then for everyone else, you can go over to registrymatters.co for the show notes and all the other links to everything that you need to go to, including over at Patreon. If you want to throw in the support, you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. I said that really fast. You can also find that on the website. You can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Also over at FYP Education to find the transcript. So, anything else, Larry? Any departing words?
Well, let me give a kudos to Timothy for his proper utilization of postage. Only a anal retentive person would notice this, but rather than just putting, it's a thick envelope, but rather than just putting extra first-class stamps that cost 60 cents each, he actually understands the system, and it's 24 cents as it stands right now for each additional ounce, so he put five separate 5-cent stamps. So he only put 1 cent more than what he needed to put in postage.
Probably didn't have access the penny stamps anyway.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But the fact that he has 5 cents and knows not to put 2 first-class stamps, that's amazing, because most people, oh, well, I'll put a second or a third. I'll put 3 first-class stamps. I know we'll get there then. And it doesn't get there any faster. If it goes over 1 ounce, then you need to put an additional ounce stamp. Those cost 24 cents. As it stands right now, they will go up on January 1st.
Well, this has been Understanding the Postage System with Larry and Andy. And without anything else, sir, I will bid you a farewell this evening. And I will talk to you next week. And
thanks.
I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.